Welcome to KUOW's Speakers Forum. I'm your host, John O'Brien. In this episode, in 1939, the influential American education reformer Abraham Flexner published an essay in Harper's Magazine titled "The Usefulness of Useless Knowledge." In it, he promoted the well-funded, free pursuit of scientific inquiry, arguing that great scientists were, quote, driven not by the desire to be useful, but merely the desire to satisfy their curiosity. Flexner was the founding director of the Institute of Advanced Study, IAS, in Princeton, New Jersey. The Institute was created in 1930 to provide a haven for curiosity-driven scientific research. Albert Einstein was one of its first professors, to be followed by a wave of European scientists fleeing fascism. Robert Digraph is the current director of IAS, and as you might expect, he has big historical shoes to fill. Digraph is a mathematical physicist with a bent towards creativity. He's a painter, too, and no small knowledge of the workings of black holes, for instance. He's from the Netherlands originally, where he is well regarded as a scientist and educator. The Dutch made him a knight, so he's got that going for him. A new book published by the Princeton University Press, The Usefulness of Useless Knowledge, includes Abraham Flexner's original essay, plus a companion piece by Robert Digraph. In it, Digraph brings us up to date on developments in research over the subsequent decades, including the effect of tightened funding. He argues that Flexner's insistence on the value of, quote, the unobstructed pursuit of useless knowledge is as important now, if not more so, than it was nearly 80 years ago. Robert Digraph spoke at the Amazon Meeting Center in downtown Seattle on May 9th. He was introduced by Microsoft technical fellow and famed space tourist Charles Simoni. We're presenting our broadcast version here. To listen to the full event, go to kuow.org/speakersforum.
Good afternoon. My name is Charles Simoni. I'm a technical fellow at Microsoft Corporation, you know, the big company across the lake. And it's my pleasure to welcome you to this this event. I have the privilege to serve as the chair of the Board of Trustees at the Institute for Advanced Study at Princeton. So it's a pleasure for me to introduce at this very special Seattle venue, Robert Digraph, who has been the director and Leon Levy professor at the Institute for Advanced Study since 2012. He is a mathematical physicist who has made significant contributions to string theory and to the advancement of computers to science education. Robert is the president of the Inter-Academy Partnership. And this is a global organization that connects all the national academies of sciences. He's also the past president of the Royal Netherlands Academy and a distinguished public policy advisor and advocate for the sciences and the arts. For his contributions to science, Robert has received the Spinoza Prize. This is the highest scientific award in the Netherlands. And he has been named the Knight of the Order of the Netherlands Lion. He's a member of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences and the American Philosophical Society. Robert is also a trained artist. He's an excellent painter, a writer, and a popular lecturer. His annual televised lectures on science attract more than 1.5 million viewers in the Netherlands. And he writes a monthly column for Holland's top newspaper. Most recently, Robert is co-author with Abraham Flexner, whom you will learn was the founding director of the Institute for Advanced Study. And the title of this book is The Usefulness of Useless Knowledge, which was recently published by Princeton University Press, which will be the topic for today's talk. Robert, I want to thank you for coming to Seattle. We are all looking forward to your insights about the importance of basic research. Robert Digraph.
Thank you, Charles. Thank you. Good evening, and a great pleasure to speak here, particularly speak about this wonderful essay that we just republished, The Usefulness of Useless Knowledge. And I must say, sometimes I joke that in these times, perhaps I should write a prequel called The Usefulness of Useful Knowledge, because I think that's... I think it's great. It gives me an opportunity to talk about some larger themes that some of you might find interesting. You know, how do we think about innovation, about creativity? How do we actually kind of change the world by things which from the beginning perhaps look entirely useless, but then impact our world? And perhaps my aim is to kind of make the word useless, within quotation marks, go viral, I think, you know, that's because I think it's very important in our society. Well, one thing that Abraham Flexner will tell more about, he created the Institute for Advanced Study, and perhaps his greatest claim to fame was to get the first professor there, which was Albert Einstein. He came to this country in 1933. And so I thought when this book was published, let's get a blurb from Albert Einstein. You know, just see, he must have said something nice about Flexner, and so I could publish this book with a blurb, Albert Einstein, I highly recommend this book. And so I looked in the ultimate quotable Einstein. You know, Einstein has wonderful quotes about everything. Look in the index, Abraham Flexner, yes, there's one quote. And then I look and it says, Abraham Flexner, one of my few enemies. So then I proposed, well, this is Einstein, a book by one of my few enemies that might even sell too, but I think we didn't go there. Actually, there's a story about this that I want to share with you, which has to do with kind of almost like two visions of what it means these days and those days to be a scientist. And as you know, Einstein, he was fascinated, as he's in his own world, by the physical universe outside, but also by the moral universe inside. Now, how do you act as a scientist in the world? And particularly if the world acts on you, as in his case. And it was kind of a clash. For instance, when Einstein was on the boat from Germany to the United States, Flexner sent him a telegram, please, Professor Einstein, don't say anything, keep a low profile, make no political statements. And of course, it was very different. This original essay was published actually in October 1939 in the magazine Harper's Magazine. And it's kind of remarkable to think. It speaks about the importance of basic research at a time where the world was really almost going up into flames. So it was really a very critical time. And yet, he was making this case, which in some sense, I think, makes it even more powerful. But I want to bring you back to 1939, just to start with. In fact, it's also the year when the New York's World's Fair was opened. It was in Queens, in New York, and the theme was the world of tomorrow. And the idea was to present how the future would look like. And I would say it's a mixed record of that exhibition. It pulled in millions of visitors. In fact, it showed the first time television. At that point, there were 300 television sets that were all in the fairground. President Roosevelt gave the first televised speech. It was also the first fax machine, the first automatic washing machine. Many interesting innovations. But also, there were some kind of the last gasp of the previous time. For instance, there was a beauty pageant of steam engines. Also, and I want to show this, this is kind of a funny clip, it showed the first robot, might be relevant here in Amazon. Electro was his name, and he could smoke a cigarette and play with his robot dog, Sparky. And here's a demonstration of Electro.
Electro, come here. And here he comes, ladies and gentlemen, walking up to greet you under his own power.
Well, at that time made a big impact. The robot could play, speak by playing gramophone records. So there was actually a second opening speech, and it was done by Albert Einstein. And he chose to speak on cosmic rays. And they had a little gadget. What they did is they caught cosmic rays, particles that bombard the Earth from the outer cosmos, caught them in the Hayden Planetarium in Manhattan, and then transferred them by telephone, whatever that meant, to the fairgrounds. And when the 10th cosmic ray was caught, they threw a big switch, and actually all the fuses blew, and the whole room turned pitch dark. And the New York Times then writes the next day, well, the audience left for a spectacle they could applaud. So in terms of science communication, it wasn't really very successful. But why it was interesting, in the speech of Einstein, about basically the world of tomorrow, what the future would bring in terms of science, he didn't mention two things. He didn't mention nuclear physics, and he didn't mention computers. And in fact, both of them, at that very time, were basically in their initial phase at his home institution, the Institute for Advanced Study. So this is an institution that was created in 1930 to be kind of an ultimate, I would say, kind of academic startup, to provide unlimited opportunities for scientists and scholars to deeply think about the world and be as far removed from reality and everyday worries. Here's a nice spread from the New York Times Magazine, 1941, seeking eternal truth in a world of chaos. And I like the picture with the looming shadow of Einstein on the blackboard. In fact, very soon after the opening speeches in the World Fair, things would start to change. In fact, in August 1939, Einstein, together with Leo Szilard, would write a famous letter to President Roosevelt, urging him to start the Manhattan Project. So certainly, nuclear physics and nuclear arms were right there. And in the 1930s, Princeton was actually the center of mathematical logic in the United States. John von Neumann came there. Kurt Gödel, perhaps the greatest logician of the last 2,000 years. Alonzo Church at the university. Alan Turing was a graduate student. And of course, there was a lot of interest in the idea of a mathematical machine that would prove all possible theorems. And that very soon became practice, because von Neumann built basically the first modern architecture with a von Neumann architecture computing machine at the Institute. It was actually made out of war surplus. I like to say it was triple helix before the double helix. It was funded by philanthropy, by the Defense Department, and by RCA and IBM, so by companies. And it had a 32 by 32-bit memory. Just think about it. And it was basically, the motivation was to do massive computations, assimilating the hydrogen bomb, because they were was the height of the Cold War. But von Neumann also used it to do the first weather predictions. In fact, the first weather predictions from January 5th, 1949, basically on 10 by 10 grid, and that first weather prediction actually took 48 hours, which is kind of funny. So it's a perfect prediction of yesterday's weather. But then very soon, it gets it down to 8 hours. And so you just have to think about that this place that was created to be as far removed from reality, 10 years later, we have here on the floor plan of the Institute, it's very small, Einstein, von Neumann, and Oppenheimer, all three working there. Einstein, at that point, the father of the peace movement. Von Neumann, with his game theory background, really thinking in terms of first strike. You know, the famous joke is, Professor von Neumann, do you really want the Soviet Union tomorrow? No, I want to do it this afternoon. And then Oppenheimer, who was, of course, caught in between these two camps and paid a large price during McCarthyism. So this place, which was totally about pure thought, certainly was part of the world. And in fact, one thing I find very striking of von Neumann, it was really visionary. In 1955, he writes a wonderful article for Fortune magazine with the title, Can We Survive Technology? And the first quarter he spends about nuclear arms. Remember, 1955, this incredible threat. But then three quarters of the article is about climate change. About the human causes, but also how it can be used as a weapon. And he, in fact, makes a rather powerful statement. He said that this, understanding the weather and climate, will merge each nation's affairs with those of every other more thoroughly than the threat of nuclear or any other war may already have done, which is a pretty amazing statement from 1955, I feel. So you'll see, one thing, of course, research has, it gives you little peeks into the future. But it's very difficult to predict that future. So I want to tell you something about Abraham Flexner, who created that magical place. He was from a large Jewish family who actually had a tough time during the kind of depression of the 1870s. And then with help of his older brother, he was able to go to Johns Hopkins University, where he studied in 2 years. Johns Hopkins in the 19th century was basically the first and perhaps the only modern research university in the United States. Now, it was basically built following the German examples. And many of the brothers had large impact. His brother Simon became the first president of what now is Rockefeller University. And Bernard Flexner was a very important person, particularly helping refugees. I'll come to that in a moment. Flexner became famous in many ways. He became actually famous quite early. He went back to St. Louis and became a teacher. And the first year, he flunked the whole class, which meant he was very critical. And that caught him the headlines in the local newspaper. Then he built his own school. He had his own ideas about education. And then in 1910, he was asked to chair a committee investigating medical research in the United States. And it was like, if anybody ever will serve on a committee, this is what you want to have as an outcome. Of the 155 medical schools at that time that were all for profit, they were undergraduate, students would never see a patient, there was no research. Of the 155, 120 either closed or had major renovations. That includes schools like at Harvard and Chicago. In fact, Chicago was called the plague spot of the country. Only a few, I think Johns Hopkins and University of Pennsylvania got a kind of a rather good judgment. And then Flexner started to put his eyes on universities. He was equally critical about American universities. For instance, he is talking about Columbia, and he is making fun of them. They had courses about practical poultry raising and beekeeping and home vegetable and fruit growing. This was the 1920s, 1930s. Institutions were very, very focused on the practical and immediate. And he was pushing them to think broadly and far away. And this was possible when, in 1930, he was asked to be the first director of the Institute for Advanced Study. It was given by a wonderful grant by the Bamberger family. And I would say the rest is history. Well, in some sense, history intervened. In 1933, April 33, of course, Hitler was in power in Germany, and all Jewish scholars basically lost their jobs and became under threat. And then there was a very intense debate, what should we do? And clearly, people like Einstein had a clear vision what to do. And in the end, the Institute played a crucial role. In fact, what they did, you see here somehow the prize list, they gave very small grants to now famous scholars. For instance, Kurt Gödel, he got a $4,000 grant, which, you know, for that price, you could kind of buy the biggest, the most important logician of its time, Stan Ulam, who would actually make the crucial design of the hydrogen bomb. All these famous European scholars, they were actually arriving at the Institute in Princeton as a kind of an Ellis Island for scholars at risk. And of course, it's important to realize how much the United States benefited from that influx of talent. I think it's important to realize these days. In fact, Flexner writes here in May 1939 that 50 years from now, the historians looking backward will, if we act with courage and imagination, report that during our time, the center of gravity in scholarship moved across the Atlantic to the United States. And if anybody made this happen, it was him. And when he passed away in 1959, it was actually mentioned that nobody made a larger contribution to the United States and to the world than Abraham Flexner. Of course, now we kind of forgotten him. I think so it's kind of terrific that I'm kind of, I'm now on book tour with him and kind of highlight his contributions. So his point is, and I want to spend some time with it, how research can totally transform society. And he mentions the example of electricity, you know, and in the 1830s, 1830s, this was like an exotic phenomenon. People were playing with it. Wasn't clear what the impact was. Now it's hard to imagine life without electricity. Now I think all of our presence is electrified. There's this famous story that when Michael Faraday was asked by the British Chancellor of the Exchequer, what's good for, he would say, I have no idea, but one day, sir, you may tax it. And that's a perfect line, I think. You know, I know when the first light bulb was switched on was actually in the editorial room of the New York Times by Edison himself. And then you might think, well, the opening line is a big, fat capitals, you know, age of electricity begins. But it's not. It's mentioned, I think, on page 8, a very small print. Well, it's like gaslight, but it doesn't smell. So it's very difficult to see when these things are happening. When quantum mechanics happened in 1900, Max Planck, the founding father, said it was an act of desperation. It was called a young man's work, you know. It was like 20-somethings. Heisenberg was still in Lederhosen, that were working about thinking about the atom. It was such an abstract theoretical concept. Now, it's estimated that 30% of our GDP is directly kind of quantum mechanical in nature. And this will grow. Quantum computers will come. But already anything connected to micro circuits or nanomaterials or lasers, of course, are totally there. And the biggest example is the life sciences. There are so many, and we would say that almost all breakthroughs in the life sciences, from decoding the genome to penicillin, etc., they were all found through sheer curiosity. In fact, one thing I'm often frustrated about, that perhaps the biggest fact of the last 300 years of history, is that life expectancy tripled in the West and in many other parts of the world. But it's not connected to one discovery or one, like, one battle being fought. But it's a tremendous driver. And there's actually, you know, it's a circle. Not only does useless thinking give useful applications, but they can lead again to useless things. And good example, one of my favorite examples, is superconductivity, which is this phenomena that if you put material at a very, very cold temperature, then actually it will have, electric current can flow for free. In 1911, it was discovered, it was an exotic phenomenon, didn't really get lots of attention. Now, of course, it's being used to build gigantic magnets, so maglev transportation trains work like that, fMRI scans, and thereby anything what these days is done in neuroscience or discovering the function of the brain is totally dependent. The whole modern field of neuroscience was born out of this technology. And in fact, it's now also used in quantum computing, because all to have these very subtle entanglements, you have to cool materials to very low temperatures. But perhaps the biggest explanation, actually my field, I'm a particle physicist, and the largest amount of magnets and the coldest spot in the universe, we think, is actually in CERN, Geneva, where the Large Hadron Collider has been built, 100 meters underground. And so the discovery of the Higgs particle in 2012, you can see as an immediate consequence of discovering this technology. So there's these long time frames. Higgs himself is a good example. You know, when he first proposed his theory about the Higgs particle, in fact, he was asked to give a lecture at the Institute. And he was very nervous, because it was the first time we'd speak about it. He actually describes that he's driving in New Jersey, and he's so nervous, he's shaking so hard, he has to park the car and catch his breath. And then, you know, in 10 years, basically nothing happened. Then 10 years, people really got interested. Another decade that a machine was designed to test it. Then another decade to build it, and then a decade of measurements. And when it finally was discovered, this is wonderful clipping where you see Peter Higgs with tears in his eye, saying, well, I'm so happy it was discovered in my lifetime. I think, well, I'm very happy as a healthy 80-something physicist, but it's, you know, it's close. And a few years ago, we all noticed that the gravitational waves were discovered. This wonderful prediction of Albert Einstein. It took literally, almost to the day, 100 years from Einstein's discovery of the field equation of general relativity to the actual measurement here on Earth. So there are long timelines in research. And I feel, well, in science, we're a little bit like the old medieval explorers. Now, they had these maps, and part of the world was mapped out, but a large part was not. And the cartographers, they didn't dare to leave blank spots on the map. I mean, what they would do, they would paint in all these kind of sea monsters, right? Which they live on in the blank spots. And I think one thing we're doing, we're always kind of fighting the sea monsters. So they are populating that what we don't know. And I always joke that, you know, if you're a cosmologist, you are happy at least you know exactly what you don't know. You know, 95% of the universe is kind of missing. It's dark energy, it's dark matter. And I think actually 95% is a good, I can ask each of you, what's your percentage of dark matter? What do you know you don't know? Probably 95 is pretty good. And by the way, 10 years ago, the 95 was zero, because the people didn't even know they didn't know. So that's changing fast. And science has this wonderful ability to push that boundary. I mean, one thing I want to talk about, too, is this immense human ability to imagine things that aren't there and push through boundaries, go, so to say, in this wide open seas populated with sea monsters and not be afraid of it. There's this wonderful saying that, you know, from Feynman, that science is the belief in the ignorance of experts. And you have to be keep an open mind. As the saying is, not that open that your mind falls out, but, you know, an open mind. And I like this saying by Francis Crick, co-discoverer of DNA. Any theory that can account for all the facts is wrong, because some of the facts are always wrong. The world is complicated, and if can I indulge in one little anecdote, for me it's a perfect example. Perhaps some of you have followed that. It was a few years ago. Somebody was making an omelet, and so she broke the first egg. It had two yolks, and then the second egg, two yolks, the third egg, two yolks, and by the sixth egg, the press was called in, and there was like a national debate in the UK about this. The chance, because this one in 1,000 eggs has two yolks, so this is completely unlikely. And there were all kind of experts, you know, chicken and egg professors, and well, you know, it might be this one chicken might be involved, the eggs might be selected on size, perhaps there's hormones or whatever. And certainly one of these experts, in his very frank moment, he describes walking through the supermarket and seeing boxes labeled double yolk eggs. And so I think there's always these other explanations around. But particularly, I think, you know, part of the book and Flexner argument is that we are not aware of how we can impact the world. And I would say we are in a tremendously exciting time of science, perhaps much more exciting even than in Flexner's time. Because at that time, we were finding the building blocks. Now, I think we are playing with the building blocks. We know that the building blocks, we know the atoms and the elementary particles that make up matter. But now we can arrange matter atom by atom. Basically any material you can want to do. And find again new natural laws. In life, we know the constituents of life, cells and DNA, and we can build anything we want out of it. As you know, and you're actually all involved in. We know the building blocks of data, of information, and now we are able, and of thinking, and we now are able to kind of combine all these ingredients. So in the old days, I think the metaphor of the old map maker is not even right. It used to be that we were trying to find what we didn't know about nature in science, but now actually it's kind of what we can possibly make. I think Richard Dawkins makes this case that, you know, all the animals, organisms that ever lived on the planet is a minute fraction of everything that can possibly live. And similar, I think, in terms of materials and other things. So we have to somehow find our way in it. And I think that's why it's important to have another discussion. What is, in some sense, the compass that people can use to explore that space? And I think basic research is crucial. And one thing I'm disappointed about, that now in 2017, we almost have to as much trouble making the case for basic research as Abraham Flexner had in 1939. So let me take you through it. You know, first of all, I think knowledge by itself, of course, is a terrific thing. You know, this, we are somehow talking about second-order effects. You know, it's wonderful to know something, just like the arts, it's great. You know, prove a great mathematical theorem. But then, actually, knowledge has all these immediate consequences. And they are not just the knowledge itself. Research develops new tools and techniques. You know, famous example, of course, is the development of the World Wide Web. In my field, particle physics. Because in CERN, for the first time, we had to do one experiment with 10,000 people. And all over the world in a completely non-hierarchical way. So we had to explore different ways of communicating. And you know, the original version of the World Wide Web, you would not read each other's web pages, you would write on each other's web pages. I'm at the Institute, we were very lucky, we got these very, very bright young people with a serious Einstein complex, but not all of them stay in physics or math, and they go all over the world. They go work at Amazon or at other companies. and totally changed the way the world looks. Perhaps most important, to realize that knowledge, fundamental knowledge, is a true public good. There's no way that anybody can capture it. It's not an institution, not an individual, in the end, not a nation. And it spreads, it flows. That's why I have this river delta on the background everywhere. And so we should have a discussion. If a government is doing things, there are many things a government can do, but only a few that only a government can do. Might be national security, but I think also providing the infrastructure in terms of knowledge, in particular basic knowledge. And finally, of course, there's innovations and startups that come out of it that were unthinkable without technology developed, often in universities and research institutes. And the famous example, of course, is the National Science Foundation grant in developing search algorithms that was given to Stanford University. It was, I think, $4.5 million grant, and it basically led to Google, Alphabet, and now its market cap is a factor, at least a factor 100,000 larger. So it's a very good investment if you get 100,000x out of it. And so we should make that case. But actually, if you look at, for instance, federal funding of research and development as a share of the gross domestic product, it grew spectacular after the war, when this country actually set a course for the world in developing infrastructure and foundations, national science foundations, etc., the large research universities in America that we all know and love. And that kind of peaked at the height of the Cold War and the Space War, and then there's a steady decline. So at that point it was 2.1% of GDP, and now it's only 0.8%. Roughly half of it is defense-oriented, always was defense-oriented. And even great institutions like the National Institute of Health, which is certainly under threat in the current administration, it had seen a steady decline in absolute real dollars over the last decade and a half, almost 20-25%, with the big exception of the stimulus funding in 2009. And if you see who are spending most on fundamental basic research, it's largely through our universities and the federal government, and companies in general, only 6% of their R&D effort is in basic research. So I speak to a lot of young scientists, and you know, if I would be a politician, then I would ask, you know, are your children better off than yourself? That's every politician asks himself. I think in science, if you ask that question, and perhaps some of you have a direct experience with this, it's life for young scientists is much more difficult than it was in the previous generation. You know, probability to get a grant application approved is less than half of what it was in the 1980s. And so this spread out of Nature magazine recently talks about the pressure. On the other hand, you know, there are unlimited possibilities, and there's talent coming from all over the world. So I think we're somehow doing a bad job advocating for basic research, for research in general. And we can discuss more about why. And I would like to share with you what I like to call the knowledge paradox. And it's the following thing. You know, clearly, when we are doing more and more research, we dig deeper and deeper. It becomes more complicated. There's more details. It's more difficult to explain what you're doing if you're doing some biology at the molecular level or doing a very complicated mathematical proof or write very complicated code. On the other hand, because of all these details, sciences have much bigger impact. It's literally in our bloodstream. It's literally in our pockets. So we have this remarkable paradox that science at some point might be everywhere around us, might be totally governing us, but it's invisible. And people are not aware of it. The public image of science is very different now than in the 1950s. You know, you would read the magazine, you see all these adverts with this positive technological view and all the great companies. And so it's like the border became like fractal. It's almost like the science is atomized. It's all around us. And so how are we dealing with it? And for instance, if you think about science communication, I'm not sure that we're doing a better job than 50 years ago. And there are, I think, so many new possibilities. And perhaps we are not really highlighting the right things. So in science, I think we a lot of excitement about the latest products, the latest discovery. People know about the Higgs particle. But you know, this was number 17, of a whole series of elementary particles. If I would go around and ask, you know, who of you would know the tau meson, or there are lots of other particles. So we always emphasize on the latest discovery. Perhaps we should talk more about the underlying process of thinking, of creativity, what it means to investigate. And Flexner writes about it. He says, you know, curiosity, which may or may not eventuate in something useful, is probably the outstanding characteristic of modern thinking. And it's not new. It goes back to Galileo, Bacon, and Newton, and must be absolutely unhampered. So I feel we should talk more about that. And I have a little anecdote to share. It's actually about Johannes van het Hof. He was a Dutch chemist. In fact, he was the first one to win the Nobel Prize in chemistry. So in 1901, the Dutch had 100% of all Nobel Prizes in chemistry. And in fact, his breakthrough was that molecules were three-dimensional. And here you see the little images that he used. You know, they fit in a small matchbox, little 3D models. In fact, my own high school in Rotterdam, in the Netherlands, had just around the corner this wonderful statue. So every morning I would walk past. And you see, he's really honored in a way, I think, that we might not honor our scientists these days. And his idea was, well, if a molecule is three-dimensional, if you look at its mirror image, it might be different. And of course, now we know this is true. Our DNA spirals a particular way. Basically, any organic molecule is of a particular handedness. So it's a great breakthrough. But when he made the breakthrough, he was criticized. In fact, I'm quoting here a passage from the famous German chemist, Kolbe, a great man of chemistry, criticizing van het Hof. He worked at the veterinary school at that point. He said, well, he didn't like, no liking for exact chemical investigation. He just found it more comfortable to mount Pegasus, the flying horse, and fly to Mount Parnassus and just declare how things were. So he had like a vision, and he didn't derive it. And van het Hof was so obsessed by that. When he finally became a professor, his inaugural lecture was about the power of imagination in science. And he took a very scientific approach. He made a list of the 200 most famous scientists at that time and put them in three categories. One was those without imagination. So these had no interest in the arts, in music, whatever. The second category was those with imagination. So they loved poetry, music. And the third was, in his words, those with perverse amount of imagination. That is, they loved alchemy, astrology, crazy stuff. And actually, in the third group, there are some very famous scientists. It's Descartes, it's Newton, it's Leibniz. Now, Newton, famously, when he discovered his laws of gravity and mechanics, he moved on to study religion. He wanted to understand the Bible, he wanted to understand history, human psychology, alchemy, and he just moved on. And I think actually this is quite understandable. One of my favorite quotes about Newton is that he must have been the happiest person ever to live on planet Earth, because he was the first to discover that there was a system behind the world. He basically discovered what are laws of nature that govern everything. So if the heavenly bodies and everything on planet Earth are governed by the same laws, why not us human beings? Why not history? Why not, I would say, chemistry and nuclear physics? Because you can make gold out of lead. It was done 10 years ago in Brookhaven Accelerator. It cost a lot of energy and time and money. But it was the most expensive piece of gold ever made. But there were some gold atoms created or nuclear out of colliding lead ones. And so I think it's important that we stress this. This is key in science, and not only in science, you know, everywhere. I mean, my favorite anecdote of Albert Einstein is when he was 5 years old, was giving a compass. Now, when he describes, he looked at the compass, and he sees the needle is pointing a certain direction. Okay, that's amazing. That's where we would stop. And then he moves with the compass through the room. He said, wait a moment. And it's always pointing in the right direction. There must be something filling the room that is guiding the compass needle, which indeed is the magnetic field. And of course, his whole work is about the gravitational field, about field equations or something. So in some sense, as a 5-year-old, he already had a feeling of this what could be. And he famously said, another of these wonderful quotes, that imagination is more important than knowledge. For knowledge is limited to all we know and understand. We just teach what we know. While imagination embraces the entire world, say, the dark matter and dark energy, stimulating progress and giving birth to evolution. And so I think that is something that we might not emphasize enough. Now, you perhaps are aware there's this famous creativity test that NASA developed for engineers. Now, and only 2% of them pass that test. And then somebody had a wonderful idea to bring the test to five-year-olds, and then 98% passed the test. And 10-year-olds, 30%, 15-year-olds, 12%. And so clearly in our education, we are doing something, well, we actually are, we're touching a button of creativity that we should probably not touch. And often I notice in my field, when you have young scientists and they want to really dive into research, they have to kind of rediscover that sense of creativity that they must have had, as we all had, as young childs. And I think this is the point where finally, and that's my last set of remarks, we might differ from Flexner. So as I said, Flexner had a point of view that science should be done basically in isolation. And there's a famous anecdote, and that might explain the bad quote of Albert Einstein. When Einstein arrived in this country, he was invited to the White House by President Roosevelt. But the letter was intercepted by Flexner, and then he writes back to the president, say, well, Professor Einstein is an important scientist, as you understand, he has to work very hard, he cannot be bothered with these kind of social events. And then Einstein is very, very upset, and gets himself re-invited, and actually opens his own mail after that. And for Einstein, indeed, it was very important to, one thing I learned at the Institute is that, you know, in his later years, there's all these wonderful sayings, but if you read them, they're really good. He spent a lot of time crafting his messages. In fact, when he had a saying that he really liked, secretary would type it out, he would cut it out and put it in a wooden box. So I feel, you know, 50 years before Twitter, he was already tweeting, you know. And indeed, I think in some sense, the love by which he crafts these messages reflects the same love in which he crafted his formulas. And so perhaps we should, you know, have a revival of other stages in the history of science. For instance, in the early 19th century, when, you know, after the Enlightenment, where there was this certainly explosion of science communication. You know, people would go everywhere, there would be public demonstrations. Huxley, what's often said, you know, Darwin's bulldog, would give lectures to factory workers on a piece of chalk and explain them, well, this chalk was found in the ground, but actually it has millions of years of history, including dinosaurs, etc. You know, and people would be totally fascinated how their sense of where they are in space and time was enlarged. And I think these days, there's basically no excuse not to spread that message. And I think we should be perhaps more creative of finding other ways. And I found this some time ago. I was on television, and I've created a website in the Netherlands for young children to do experiments. And they told me, asked me, can you do an experiment? So I brought a balloon filled with water. It's kind of fun to do. And you find a lighter and try to burn a hole in the balloon. And it won't work, but you can do it, you know, on top of somebody's head to add some more drama to it. And then I thought, well, why doesn't that work? And it's a nice spiel. Well, if you put a kettle, an empty kettle on the stove, it gets very hot very soon. If it's filled with water, you have to wait a long time. And that's why, you know, if you're close to the sea, you have moderate climate, etc. And I had a ball explaining fundamental concepts in physics. And the next morning, I get an email from a very famous scientist. And he said, well, Robert, I loved your presentation, but of course, your explanation was totally wrong. I think, oh, no, that's, you know, if you ever do any outreach, you know, particularly if you feel well science, you know, if you make a mistake in the science, you're just, it's the worst thing to happen. And then he said, well, because you didn't show the experiment to explain about specific heat and thermodynamics, you show the experiment to explain that you can actually trust the laws of nature. Now, there's a law of nature preventing you from burning the hole. And that's why this trick always works. There's this famous saying by the great physicist John Wheeler, who invented the term black hole. He was a legend in Princeton. He worked till his late 90s. And he said, like, physics is magic without magic. Now, it's a wonderful stage trick, but in some sense it works, always works. And I think, you know, somebody asked me the other day, you know, if there's one thing you could wave a magic wand. There's one thing that everybody would understand. What would it be? And my answer was, well, the scientific method. The fact that there is a consistent way to learn about the world, what we call science. And it comes with many things. It comes with, not with absolute truth, it's always approximate. It comes with a sense of uncertainty. You're always in dialogue. But there are certain things that you can trust. And it's a very systematic way to understand the world and to understand us. And I think that is something that we have to carry across. And so I find it amazing that there is this human ability to do this. It might be one of the things most that make us humans, that we have this urge to go to the very frontiers of knowledge and peek and see what's there, and that you have individuals that can do this. There was a famous saying by Wellington, who was the who defeated Napoleon, the Iron Duke. He said, you know, in war and in life, it's all about knowing what is at the other, on the other side of the hill. So you are, and he actually took that literally. When he had friends, when he was retired, he would take them in a coach and go to some new part of England that nobody had been, and they would stare at the landscape. He would ask, well, okay, is there a lake, a forest, a village behind the hill? And then you check. You know, that's a great thing. You can check this. And he was mostly right. You know, there's some ability to take information, small little bits, what we perhaps call intuition, or allow us to do so. And there are visionary people who can do this. I think whether it's in art or in science or in politics or in enterprises, there are a few individuals that are able to see something that isn't there yet. And I think that's an absolutely magic ability. And I want to end by reading a quote, see if I can read it, from Flexen. This actually is the opening paragraph of the piece. Is it not a curious fact that in a world steeped in irrational hatred, October 1939, with threatened civilization itself, men and women, old and young, detach themselves wholly apartly from the angry current of their daily life to devote themselves to the cultivation of beauty, to the extension of knowledge, to the cure of disease, to the amelioration of suffering, just as though fanatics were not simultaneously engaged in spreading pain, ugliness, and suffering. The world has always been a sorry and confused sort of place. Yet, poets and artists and scientists have ignored the factors that would, if attended to, paralyze them. And I think these are, I find personally, very encouraging words, and it's a great pleasure to have shared them with you. Thank you very much.
Thanks for streaming this episode of Speakers Forum from KUOW 94.9 Seattle. Robert Digraph is the director of the Institute of Advanced Study in Princeton, New Jersey. Check out the recently published book, The Usefulness of Useless Knowledge, which presents an influential 1939 essay by Abraham Flexner, plus a companion piece by Digraph. Robert Digraph spoke at the Amazon Meeting Center in downtown Seattle on May 9th, 2017. You can hear the full recording on our website, kuow.org/speakersforum. Tune in again soon.